Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. This morning, we're going to get some facts to back up what many families and households that listen to our stations and programs already know. We're going to welcome a director from the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health to discuss a brand new national poll that amplifies how badly the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted Latino, Black, and Native American households, both in terms of the financial situations and the educational implications. Then we're going to air out a few of the concerns about and potential benefits of wind power as we touch base with the New England for Offshore Wind Coalition to learn more about developing offshore wind projects coming to the region. And we'll close reminding you that it's time to begin making strides. Our final guest, the executive director with the American Cancer Society, will explain the important and exciting developments related to this year's American Cancer Society at the Making Strides Against Breast Cancer drive-through experiences and pink parades of celebration happening all over the state. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. To ensure safety during the COVID-19 pandemic and encourage residents to receive their annual flu shot, the Stratford Health Department is hosting two drive-through flu clinics. The first is coming up Monday, September 28th in the parking lot of Bunnell High School from 10 to 2, and the second is Saturday, October 3rd in the parking lot of the Birdseye Municipal Complex, also from 10 to 2. All ages are welcome and walkers will not be turned away. Attendees are asked to complete required paperwork ahead of time, however, and to bring a photocopy of their license and insurance card. A flu consent form and photocopies are required for each person in any vehicle attending the flu clinics. There are no appointments necessary. Forms and flu clinic instructions can be found on townofstratford.com/flu. Well, as you heard in our introduction this morning, we're going to be talking a little bit about the groups in our communities, our friends, our neighbors, our coworkers, the families of the kids that our kids play with, and a little bit of how they've been sort of quote unquote clobbered by the fallout from this COVID-19 pandemic, especially both in terms of ongoing educational concerns and financial challenges. A new poll that's just out this week finds the majorities of Latino, Black, and Native American households across the U.S. facing serious financial problems during the coronavirus outbreak. And I'm so pleased to welcome Robert Blendon. Bob is a professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and he was a co-director of a special project that brought this entire issue to light. Bob, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Now, you were a co-director with this project that involved NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the School of Public Health there at Harvard. First of all, tell us a little bit about your colleagues and a little bit of the backstory on how this all came together.
Well, so first, the survey we did is somewhat unusual from the polls you would hear. Our group has been involved for many years in surveying people who were caught in natural disasters. For that, and in a natural disaster, what you find is whether it's the wildfires in California, the hurricanes hitting the Gulf, is that almost everybody's impacted by these terrible events. But when you go further, they're a smaller share of people whose lives are really being threatened. They can't go on. Their households really are not financially or structurally viable. And this survey, again, based on we've done this before, looked at only people who said they had really serious problems since the COVID-19 epidemic started. Our research group has a particular role, is that our efforts are to try to give voice to people across the country about what's happening in their lives. So people who are in decision-making roles and people who are not being impacted know something what's going on. But this survey is unusual in that we pushed people and saying, is this issue really serious for you and your family? And then if it didn't, we just focused on that. And where the findings were very surprising to us, the number of people who reported they had very serious problems and continued since COVID-19 were much larger than we expected. And for those of us who listen to the news regularly, billions of dollars have been put up to aid people during this very difficult crisis with the epidemic. It may even be trillions of dollars. Federal, state, charitable groups talking about all the time, we're focusing our funds. They basically put a cushion under people who are at very high risk. And here in this survey, we examined three groups who are dying at incredibly high rates from this, and that's the Latino community, Black and Native American. And yes, they have a history of discrimination and economic problems, but we thought with all of the funding that was coming, there would be a safety net, a cushion for these groups. All of us hear these public service announcements all the day, every day, and say we're all in this together. And our findings of the overall survey is that that just isn't true. Mm-hmm. Not only are these minority communities just being clobbered by the economic side effects, really dying of this situation, but if you earn less than $100,000 a year, every ounce stack, you are so much more at risk of all these problems. And if you lost your job or wages cut back since the epidemic, I thought that everybody was receiving special programs and their lives were holding together. And a very large number of people who've had their livelihood cut back are in real trouble. For that, and at the most basic level. And when people say, well, what do you mean by real trouble? Well, among the minority groups, more than 4 in 10 say their savings are gone, just about gone. So just think about a problem next week or that something unexpected. They have no savings that are left. Also, with all so-called relief, they're having incredible problems paying their credit card debt, their bank loans, their mortgages, utilities, rent. For that, they are really struggling to hold the household together. So that is sort of how we got here. Our role is to give voice to people, and so people broadly can understand about their lives. And the findings are somewhat sobering because there are a lot of people who are not only at risk of dying and dying, they're having incredible financial problems trying to keep their household together.
Sure. We also know that a lot of times when even small polls are done, it could sometimes take months and months for the results to finally get kind of sorted and surfaced. And you guys moved really quickly. This poll was conducted between the first week of July and the first week of August. And you've already turned around the information and really crunched the numbers and come up with some important information. And you also were part of a trinity of heavy hitters that were acting as point on this. I understand the former CDC acting director Bresser was on board with you,
right,
as well as former Chicago Public Health Commissioner Julie Morita. Let's talk a little bit about the dynamic among the three of you and some of the other information you hope to seek through this survey.
So the dynamic is, in today's America, if you're really going to try to have an impact on getting people to understand problems, you need to bring together groups from very different backgrounds. And so just as you highlight in preparing this, as well as National Public Radio had a committee of editors that worked with us in things that they thought would be important to know. And that is the critical questions when you're disrupting people's lives and say, will you talk to me? Will you do an interview about your life? You want things where you can actually say to them, if you answer our questions, we think we can help you and help the country for that. So the three work together. And also there is a commitment in the middle of a national emergency of turning this around quickly. And so we worked very, very hard with a survey firm that used a lot of very difficult techniques. For instance, we gave people a chance to answer on the internet, by landline, by cell phone, because there are people in this country at the moment that don't have access to one of them. And so we wanted to be sure that you weren't locked out because you just didn't have access. So this was an effort to respond to a national emergency, turn it around very quickly, and be sure that we ask questions that if a broader audience knew might lead for really help for people who are in trouble.
Very good. Folks, if you're just joining us here this morning, we're with Dr. Robert Blendon. He's a professor at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and he partnered with a couple of other folks we were just talking about on a new poll called The Impact of Coronavirus on Household by Race and Ethnicity, which involved NPR broadcast journalists, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard School of Public Health. In the back end of the interview that we have now, Dr. Blendon, let's talk a little bit about something else that you discovered, the impact of the coronavirus on some of our youngest generation and those who are being pushed into situations that involve distance learning. Challenges to some of these ethnic groups are bad enough when there is a full-time classroom situation going pre-pandemic. Now it's a whole new ballgame, right?
Yes, and so this is really critical and something we just want to talk widely about. The American dream, particularly for members of minority communities, is that their kids will have a chance to have a life and broader opportunities than their families did before. That really requires a high-quality structured education. And more than 3 in 10 of the minority communities we interviewed, the families are having a tough time turning their crowded apartments, whatever it is, into a classroom. For that, it's very hard, and they're reporting that it's a serious thing of how they can structure with other people running in and out and other family members living there, making this structured. And then added to this is that we found that a considerable number, and we're talking about the moment, about half of Latino households, a third black households, and 50% of Native Americans are having a problem keeping their computer systems connected. So it's not only that they don't have internet service, but many of them report their internet service is going down. And just think about the implications. Your child's taking a 4-hour class on mathematics, which is just critical for their future. And these parents are reporting to us that in the course of this lecture, the computer keeps going down. The connectiveness isn't working. So we've basically taken people where the best outcome for them is a structured in-classroom education. Converted their apartments or small homes suddenly into teaching places, and we just have to alert people their computer connectedness is going down. It's not just a matter, many school superintendents said, oh, we've sent out 8,000 iPads. Well, a lot of the services are not adequately working. And just think about it. You have a child in the middle of the math class, and it disappears for 40 minutes, and then it comes back again. Mm-hmm. So these are very real problems, because these children will be scarred for years if they can't keep their basic education going while we go through this national crisis.
So to recap, many of our listeners heard a disproportionate amount of promotion regarding public benefit programs and emergency fortification of financial channels to ostensibly help the most challenged communities and neighbors here during the coronavirus pandemic. And secondly, we continue to hear this drumbeat of how these thousands and thousands of new computers are hitting the streets and becoming available to make distance learning possible. But yet your work and your survey has shown where both of those concepts are significantly questionable. So I guess in closing with you at this point, Dr. Blendon, where do you take the data and information, and what do you hope to do with it now that it's public?
So the hope is that we really will have a national and statewide examination of why, with all this money being spent, it's not providing a life raft for very vulnerable people. What is it? People can't understand it. It's not coming. It's very complex. We don't know the answer. Secondly, we have an awful lot of science computer whizzes in this country, and we really have to take an examination. What can we do to make the connectivity for communities with very modest incomes better? We are a country that's very good at moving in this area. So the hope is to get this with no thought of our part when we planned this. We didn't realize that the Congress at this moment is saying we're not going to continue any of this special aid. So I don't know where it goes or what, but it's hard to believe these very sobering numbers among people who are dying at high rates are not going to get a lot worse if Congress just decides it's going to stop the special aid. So it's hard to look at our findings and just say, well, we'll just walk away from federal underwriting the disaster. But what we really have to examine is, how do you get support for people in a national emergency, which this is with the virus, all of whom we thought would be over a lot sooner? How do we keep these families financially afloat while they're dealing with this very terrible virus? And how do we make sure, much more structurally, that families that are in a difficult situation can educate their children at home? Well, and the hope was that we'd move everybody in the classrooms and figure out how to do that. We have not at the moment, but we want to get people to seriously look at how we improve the education for vulnerable people in their homes. So the two things are, in a disaster, it is possible to get financial aid for people to carry them through the disaster so their households don't fall apart. And we just hope this poll will provoke that discussion. And secondly, how that we make for families that are very vulnerable, education in the household, something that's really useful for kids. It gives them a chance for a life future.
The poll that we're talking about is titled The Impact of Coronavirus on Households by Race and Ethnicity, a joint effort from NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health, of which our guest this morning, Professor Dr. Robert Blendon, is a co-director. I thank you so much, Dr. Blendon, for taking time with us this morning to
lay it out. And John, thank you and your audience for having me.
Well, if you're detecting something in the air, it's because there is something new in the air. It's New England for Offshore Wind, a new regional coalition of environmental advocacy organizations, educational institutions, justice and health organizations, and business alliances. And in the coming years, it's important for you to know that old, dangerous, and polluting fossil fuel power plants are going to be going offline more than ever. And at the same time, energy demand is absolutely going to be increasing as states, in particular us here in Connecticut, electrify transportation and heating. And New England for Offshore Wind believes offshore wind is a crucial resource to fill that gap. And their new lead coordinator is on the line with us. Susanna Hatch here is with us for this morning's Midpoint segment. So, Susanna, good morning. I guess it was just over last summer that there was collaborations that began going on to produce this new entity. Tell us a little bit about the backstory and the lead up to the launch of New England for Offshore Wind.
Yeah, thank you for having me, John. It's great to talk to you. So I'm working at the Environmental League of Massachusetts, and it was kind of the brainchild of that organization, as well as other environmental organizations affiliated with the National Wildlife Federation and the League of Conservation Voters. And so the backstory is that, you know, a lot of this offshore wind activity has been going on a state-by-state basis up till now. Connecticut has had some very strong commitments coming out at the end of 2019 to procure a lot of offshore wind. But we recognize that there's kind of this regional conversation that's really missing here. And so that's why we really started the conversation of forming this coalition and decided that it made sense to make it a very broad-based coalition, as you cited, including all those groups as well as labor unions, to make sure that we are, a strong group coming from a broad array of perspectives, really all speaking to this same issue. And so we have been kind of working behind the scenes and gaining steam, and officially launched on August 26th to the public. And the main idea is that we really need regional collaboration on offshore wind in order to bring it to the scale that we need to combat climate change, but also just to bring it to a scale that we need to meet our energy demands. And in New England, we have a lot of interconnected systems that just really would benefit from regional collaboration, including workforce development. Another example is wildlife mitigation. You know, right whales, for example, don't respect state boundaries. And so We're really focused on making sure that the states are working together on all these challenges, and also, you know, setting our sights higher on offshore wind so that we can actually get to where we need to go to provide good jobs and combat climate change.
And Susanna, this really seems like the right move at the right time, given the newly energized effort to kind of morph the Connecticut state pier into a more of a service base for industries like the ones you're supporting, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's actually a really great example of all of the sorts of things that need to happen to bring this industry to scale. You know, a lot of times when people think about the jobs and economic opportunity, they think about the very direct, you know, offshore wind technicians that are working on the turbines, which is, of course, a huge part of it. But there's a huge piece of infrastructure that needs to be built, and supply chain that needs to be built, that includes port infrastructure. So in Connecticut, we have the New London Pier, as well as Bridgeport is going to see huge benefits from this offshore wind industry in terms of infrastructure. And we're going to need it, I'll call it a constellation of these kind of things, up and down the coast of New England to get to where we need to go. So in Massachusetts, we have similar infrastructure, and coordinating on that makes a lot of sense.
Oh, that's great, and creates a precedent that could help guide Connecticut's efforts to better economize and get the best bang for the taxpayer or grantor's dollars.
Exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there's a huge focus on the affordability of the energy itself. For offshore wind, it's, you know, because of its stable price, it really is projected to save ratepayers billions of dollars over time. But there's also, you just nailed it on the head, there's also great opportunities for economies of scale and minimizing cost if we're working together. Because, you know, if states are coordinating on procuring this energy, for example, that could bring the price down because it's kind of a bigger piece of the pie instead of all of us working on it separately.
So for inlanders who don't get down to the coast or vacation at the beach, I guess it's important to clarify at this point that there have been wind generating operations that have been successfully installed and have been working for years along the New England coast. Can you talk a little bit from a historical perspective about how that industry has bloomed up to the point where we're at today?
Yeah. So we do have a few turbines in the water in New England. We have a wind farm off of Block Island in Rhode Island that is five turbines. And they actually, I think a couple of months ago, installed two more turbines off the coast in Virginia. So not New England, but that's the extent of the offshore wind turbines in the United States thus far. Meanwhile, Europe has thousands and thousands of turbines off the water. So the U.S., you know, this is really like, it's an industry that's ready to launch in the U.S. and is on the cusp, and we have yet to really harness it at a large scale that will provide the benefits needed both environmentally and economically, which is why we're really excited about it.
From your perspective, what are a few of the things that you have learned from our European counterparts who have so successfully populated what were once, clear coasts and coastlines and clear views with these turbines? My understanding is that they have become not only quite accepted, but almost points of pride for so many of the communities that now look out to the coastline and see these vast arrays of windmills and wind turbines spinning.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well. I mean, I'm sure that they had a robust stakeholder process, you know, throughout the time period that they've been installing all of these, but Europe has really strong strong climate mandates and recognizes that offshore wind is one of the best tools in our toolkit among a bunch of tools that we're going to have to use to get there. So they've really been harnessing it. But we really have a lot to learn from Europe. For one thing, they've been exploring different methods of transmission of offshore wind, which we can definitely learn from. They've also started experimenting with some new energy generation of what we call renewable hydrogen, which hasn't really existed yet. And they also have done some really interesting scientific studies. One came out recently, I think it was from the Netherlands. So I'm not sure if it was the Netherlands or another country, on the effect of the offshore wind industry on the lobstering industry. And of course, in Maine in particular, but also in southern New England. That's a really important industry for us to keep an eye on. And it was encouraging to see that study that came out actually showed positive impact on lobster. So we've got a lot to learn, but we also have a lot to study and create and innovate on our own. We have academic and research institutions that are part of our coalition that feel strongly that and have been doing work for decades on researching wind energy in general, but feel strongly that, you know, we have a lot to learn from Europe, but we also have a unique opportunity to really make it better and really make it work for our geography and the United States in general. It's an exciting opportunity.
Well, we're going to come back and talk about a little bit more about the opportunities when you can help convince opponents that may be more of the attitude of adopting kind of a not in my backyard philosophy versus the upsides and the things that are positive about offshore wind, which is considered a game changer for the New England grid. Offshore wind is the single biggest lever that we can pull to reduce emissions, address climate crisis, and meet energy needs and grow economic opportunity simultaneously. Susanna Hatch is the lead coordinator for New England offshore wind, and their website is newenglandforoffshorewind.org if you'd like to click on that and learn all about what their work is on your own time. We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about some of the environmental issues and concerns tied to offshore wind, as well as the issues that may involve recreational and commercial fishermen. We'll be back. Stay with us. Do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the event tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Coming up on September 24th, Connecticut singer, songwriter, and self-described cancer thriver Rachel Sage will bring together a powerful group of performers for a great cause. Bravery on Fire is benefiting the Foundation for Women's Cancer. This virtual event will feature a variety of performers, including Grammy winners Paula Cole and Lisa Loeb. September is Gynecologic Cancer Awareness Month, and Sage, who is in remission from uterine cancer, felt it was more important than ever to shine a light on these cancers that affect so many women but receive relatively little public attention or research funding. To watch and support the cause, just tune into the event being live streamed from braveryonfire.com. We're back, and Susanna Hatch is with us. She's the lead coordinator for New England for Offshore Wind, a regional coalition of environmental advocacy organizations, educational institutions, justice and health organizations, and business alliances that are working on proliferating wind turbines off the coast of New England. Getting into some of the environmental concerns, Susanna, first, we've got kind of a unique situation here in Connecticut where the bulk of our listeners are, as well as out on Long Island, because I don't know how much, if at all, New York is in play with your organization. But tell us a little bit about the difference in the way that wind turbines might act and work in Long Island Sound if they end up there versus along more northerly coastlines where they have kind of unfettered access to the winds that are coming in off the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are right now, just to give you a picture of where things are, there are federally designated lease areas off the coast of Massachusetts and Rhode Island. So not within Long Island Sound. There's also a small lease area off the coast of New York, and the federal agency that's in charge of that is working on defining further lease areas off of New York, because New York is actually very much in play. They've set some very high targets for offshore wind and are really going big, which is actually part of the reason why we're really focused on having New England coordinate, so that we are staying in the game, if you will. So at this point in time, it doesn't look like there will be turbines within Long Island Sound. Of course, I can't predict the future, but sure. I think it's probably
not in the plan today.
It's probably more likely that they're going to be more kind of in the area that they've already been designated in, just because the winds are stronger out
there.
I don't know for sure, but I don't suspect that they would be in the Sound. To speak a little bit to the environmental concerns, we are working with wildlife focused partners, as well as partners that are focused on the protection of birds and really believe that offshore wind can be developed responsibly in a way that protects those folks, those creatures. And one of the organizations that we're working with in Connecticut on that is Save the Sound. So we definitely are keeping an eye on that and want to make sure that this is done right.
Well, what are a couple of the most important things that people need to know based on other areas of the United States or the global community where wind turbines are, in significantly greater number?
You mean in terms of the environmental?
Yeah. Yeah,
concern?
About impact to the birds, the fish, the whales. Are you faced a lot of times with people who are opposing it because they have a misconception about how environmentally harmful wind turbines could be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we do. We do hear from folks that are concerned about the harm of turbines to birds and to whales in particular. And we also are concerned about and want to make sure that we're protecting those species. I will highlight that there have been studies that have shown that although there are some impacts to birds in particular from turbines, it's completely minuscule in comparison to buildings and infrastructure and cats, actually, household cats. But that, that is not to say that we aren't focused on making sure that we are that we're minimizing impacts to birds and the biggest and whales and turtles, et cetera. And the biggest thing that you can do to really mitigate impacts is to make sure that the siting of where these are placed are not placed in places of heavy migration patterns, for example. So that's one thing that's extremely important and that our partners are very focused on whenever they're designating these federal lease areas, making sure that they aren't sited where, where these species need to travel through, or where, we also want to avoid areas that are extremely valuable fishing land, for example, because we think that this industry can coexist with all of those different uses and species. Mm. And there have been some actually really interesting scientific studies on what more can be done. I don't think it's been peer reviewed or anything, but I think that one study that came out of Norway that was really interesting was thinking about painting the turbine blades different colors and how that really reduced the impacts on birds. I don't know if that has been a peer reviewed study yet, but I'm pointing it out because one of the important things for us to do is not just to focus on siting these farms in responsible locations, but also on making sure that we are continuing to monitor and study impacts so that we can learn from wind turbines that are installed so that we can continue to improve and mitigate impacts.
And it does seem that you guys really want to make commercial and recreational fishermen not only key stakeholders as this program rolls out, but partners as well. What can you say to the commercial and recreational fishermen to help assuage some of the concerns coming out of that demographic?
Yeah, so the fishing concerns are definitely definitely out there. I would say I think the conversation is probably fairly different from the recreational and the commercial fishermen. We had a recreational fisherman speaking at our launch press conference who actually noted that fishing has improved in the Block Island wind farms, and that they create habitat and all of that, and commercial fishermen have expressed concern about safety of navigation and impacts to their industry. But we really believe that if everybody's at the table and thinking oriented towards solutions, that these industries can really work together. And what we're really focused on is the bottom line is that climate change is really the leading threat to wildlife, including to fish. Some of our waters off the coast of New England, particularly the Gulf of Maine, actually, are some of the fastest warming waters in the world, and that is having a huge impact on fish that we're already seeing. The recreational fisherman that spoke actually said he's catching vastly different fish than he was catching even 5 and 10 years ago. And so we're really, you know, offshore wind is one of the biggest levers we can pull to combat climate change. And in New England, because of our geography and population density, et cetera, it's really critical to combating climate change here. And so that's why, you know, we are also really concerned about making sure that we can combat climate change so that we, you know, still have fish to fish in the ocean.
And another demographic that may not immediately come to mind in the mix here are communities of color and racial equity. Tell us in the last couple of minutes that we have with you, Susanna, how would increasing offshore wind affect communities of color?
Yeah, so there are a lot of different benefits that we're seeing. One is from the health side of things. Really, for too long, our low-income communities and communities of color have been forced to sacrifice their health for our energy needs based on the siting of, you know, the siting of highways, but also the siting of power plants. And we're seeing these effects really clearly with COVID-19 and how much more at risk those communities are because of the localized air pollution. So we really need to transition away from fossil fuels to improve that air quality and health outcomes for our most vulnerable communities. So that's one aspect of offshore wind and how it can benefit those communities, because it really has the potential to close those older polluting power plants, as well as providing job opportunities for the community. But it's also important to note that for communities of color, you know, they pay disproportionately high percentages of their income on utility bills. And so we're very excited about the fact that the cost of offshore wind has continued to decline to the point where it is starting to outcompete fossil fuels, and in the long run actually will save ratepayers billions of dollars over time. And so we are also focused on that aspect of things in terms of the, you know, both cleaning up the air, but also providing us with affordable energy.
Yeah. Well, if I was texting you back, I would be saying, like, saving billions of dollars. So that's a great way to end things for now. Susanna, we really appreciate you taking the time and laying out all of these details about the potential for offshore wind development here. Susanna Hatch is the lead coordinator for New England for Offshore Wind, a regional coalition recently launched and calling on the New England states to collaborate to responsibly develop offshore wind. You can learn more about them by going to newenglandforoffshorewind.org. Susanna, best of luck to you, and thank you so much for taking time to be on the show this morning. Wrapping up with a subject that we touch upon around this time every year, making strides against breast cancer. You know, that's always been more than a walk. It's really a movement. But because of the pandemic, this fall is going to look a lot different. But our communities here in Connecticut and everyone's passion to end breast cancer is really needed now more than ever. We're talking with Executive Director with the American Cancer Society, Wendy Matthews, on the subject. And we'll be inviting you to take advantage of some really cool new ways that ACS has come up with to handle making strides in a COVID era. Wendy, thank you so much for being on the program.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So the information that we're seeing here is that along with all of the other negative implications of COVID-19, it has essentially cut the amount of funding that is available for breast cancer and cancer research by about half. But I think it's important to start the discussion by firing people up with some inspiration about why they should not only continue, but try to work even harder this year, because I imagine some of the national experts that you talk to are providing you with some good news about research that has been funded through Making Strides allocations in the past.
Oh, yes, absolutely. Certainly for more than two decades, Making Strides Against Breast Cancer has helped fund breakthrough research, 24/7 support for cancer patients, and access to life-saving screenings. So we've made leaps in progress that have saved 375,000 lives, roughly. You know, mortality rates are declining overall, and that is largely due to research that has been funded around treatments, but also information about prevention. So, you know, helping fewer people be diagnosed at a later stage.
Well, toward prevention and awareness, what are a couple of the most important things that you'd like to communicate to our audience? Obviously, everybody's being barraged with information, but it's so always kind of heavily colored with the COVID-19 angle. Removing that from the picture, what are a couple of the most important preventative messages that you want to share with women and those who are affected by breast cancer?
Well, I think preventive screenings for sure, you know, would be one I would underline and highlight, making sure that you're up to date on your age appropriate screenings. And that being said, also having a dialogue with your primary care or your, you know, medical health professional around your own personal risk factors and knowing what your personal risks are so that you can, you know, address them appropriately, you know, with the appropriate screenings. Mm.
Yeah, when it comes to screenings, I guess we're kind of blessed here in Connecticut with a lot of the work that was done now going on a decade ago to help expand the types of screenings that are provided, particularly for women and individuals with dense breast tissue, right?
Yeah, yes, yep.
So this fall, as you said, it's going to look different because the Making Strides Against Breast Cancer events are taking a whole new kind of angle here. Let's talk a little bit about the lead up and the decision making that went around. I imagine it was probably back in February or March when you guys started seeing the COVID storm clouds on the horizon and suspected you might need to devise some changes.
Absolutely. You know, I think that as an organization like the American Cancer Society, so much of what we do relies on gathering groups of people together for large-scale events. We obviously have had to not just pivot once, but continuously pivot through the course of the last 6 months. Originally, with our event season peaking in the spring, it was sort of the shock and awe of what was happening, as I think, in, you know, for all of us in society, sort of adjusting to the reality of what was happening. And I think the one thing that we've been able to benefit from with our breast cancer movement is that we've had a little bit more lead time in planning. But we didn't really know how the public was going to react and trying to activate in one way, shape, or form in the middle of all of this. And what has been nice is that we're finding, as we've regrouped and figured out a way that we can pull folks together, it's just that as we've reached out to some of our key stakeholders, they still want to come out and put on their pink and find a safe way to gather to show their support and you know, and be with one another that have that common sort of, you know, passion.
Yeah. So in the past, these Making Strides events were somewhat community or regional centric, kind of like the Relays for Life. And they did take on that kind of atmosphere of celebration and advocacy. That is changing somewhat, but the celebration of survivors and the advocacy for research is unchanged.
Correct. You know, we're just having to approach it differently and in a number of different ways because we're not going to get everyone virtually and we're not going to get everyone to come out and drive through. So we're going to have to sort of, you know, do a little bit of everything.
So tell us, starting October 4th with the Making Strides Against Breast Cancer of Greater Hartford, how the event this year is changing and what people need to know to not only participate, but to bring more of their circle of friends, neighbors, and coworkers into the picture, because you're working so hard to make up for this 50% drop in research funding, which is historic. The most, I should say, the least investment that's being made potentially this century.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've never faced a threat to our mission like COVID-19. And, you know, I think you say it very well. We have millions of dollars at risk, or research, you know, in research at risk. And so I think that this, you know, and that's at stake this year alone. So I think that certainly there's an urgency. There's a critical need for activation. To have a delay in research and or to not be able to serve patients, you know, now that are either impacted by both cancer and COVID-19, or down the road, to, you know, there may be, you know, an increase in folks that need our services because they have not had access to screenings as we've gone through this year, with so much on hold in March and early in the year because of the stay-at-home orders, et cetera, with the pandemic. So I think that, you know, to inspire folks, they can still make a difference. It will still be fun. We just want folks to feel that sense of urgency so that they, if they're passionate, they still want to come out and join with us. There's a number of different ways to participate. It's whatever a person or an individual and their team are comfortable with it. So we do have activations. You mentioned October 4th, you know, beginning October 4th in Hartford. We're going to have a celebratory car parade where we're going to be able to celebrate survivorship and come together, and folks can pink out their cars, and we'll have photographs and music and a lot of safe and fun things for people to participate in from the safety of their own vehicle. Hmm. Very similar type activities are going on at our Making Strides Against Breast Cancer sites throughout the state. And in addition, we'll be having some fun things for folks, such as qualifying for a scavenger hunt, and we'll be running challenges virtually. There will be a sort of a nationwide activation on what we call Super Sunday later in the month. So we're really looking at these drive-through type events as a way to come in person, but it's only a piece of the way people can participate and help fight breast cancer with the American Cancer Society in October.
And do I understand from the implications of something called Pink Parades of Celebrations that maybe some of these vehicles and their passionate advocates are going to be leaving the site en masse and driving around their communities?
I think where we have groups of volunteers that plan that such a thing, that is the case.
Oh,
in
good.
Most cases, the portion that we're planning, they'll be contained within, you know, one location. So
Great.
It'll be a parade around. There'll be a route map around a specific location.
Super.
Yes.
So we want people to go to makingstrideswalk.org to find the Making Strides Against Breast Cancer event for 2020 in their area. And we'll once again remind you that from 9 to 11 on Sunday, October 4th, you can go to Founders Plaza in East Hartford for the Greater Hartford event. You can go to the White Memorial Conservation Center in Litchfield that same day, October 4th, from 10:30 to 11:30 for the Litchfield County event. There is one at Rocky Neck State Park in Niantic on Sunday, October 18th, beginning at 10:30 in the morning. On that same day, October 18th, at Lighthouse Point Park in New Haven from 10:30 to 11:30. And finally, on Sunday, October 25th, Making Strides Against Breast Cancer of Fairfield County will take over Sherwood Island State Park in Westport from 9 to noon. So that's pretty much all you need to know. Once again, go to makingstrideswalk.org for more information and how to register and continue to support the cause, because as we've heard from our guest this morning, Wendy Matthews, Executive Director with the American Cancer Society, the impact of COVID-19 is going to reduce their ability to fund cancer research by approximately 50% in 2020, and we really can't let that number wane. In fact, we'd like to bump it up. And that's why our radio stations are going to bat for the American Cancer Society and all of the breast cancer survivors and researchers and all the family and loved ones who have lost others to breast cancer. So, Wendy, best of luck with the events, and we will talk to you again soon. Thanks for joining us. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.